Okay, so evolution of supernovae and the winds of massive stars. And okay, so why do we want to do this? Well, most stars lose mass during their evolution. We know that, and some of us wish we were like this, but some of us are the opposite. Anyway, but most stars lose mass during their evolution, and stars greater than 8 solar masses lose a lot of mass during their evolution, and then they explode as supernova. And all the material around the star is going to be accumulating around this star. So when the supernova explodes, it's going to expand into this medium, and it's not going to expand into the ISM. And therefore, the evolution of the supernova or the remnant is due. It depends on the structure of this medium, and that's why we need to study it. So there are several supernovae that have seen. Wow, this thing is a killer. There are several supernovae that we know have evolved in wind-blown bubbles. And of course, if you needed an excuse to study it, here is a great one, supernova 87A. And if I get time, I'll talk about it. This one is thought to have been in a wind-blown bubble too. This says ROSAT HRI, but I don't know. Every time I look at it, it looks like a brain MRI or something. So, like one of those things where they say, this is your brain on drugs. This is your brain on astronomy. Anyway, so this is supernovae. As I said, many core collapse supernovae, they will occur in wind-blown bubbles. Well, actually, almost everything should have a wind-blown bubble around it, depending on how much mass it loses or whatever. The first thing you'll notice is that the luminosity of the remnant within a bubble is very small compared to the ISM, and I'll show you that. The X-ray radio optical emission, anything which is due to circumstellar interaction, which is what most of the emission from a supernova remnant comes from, is due to circumstellar emission. It depends on the density of the medium, and usually it goes as density squared. And therefore, the luminosity will be reduced considerably. That's one of the most important things. You won't see them. Changing the circumstellar environment affects the radiation signatures, and the supernova remnant may not actually go through all the classical stages of evolution. So there's been quite a bit of work done, especially in one decade, like in the 80s and early 90s, and then there wasn't much done for a long time about this, even though we keep getting better and better data. So I keep talking about circumstellar bubbles, and you're going to hear a lot about this even tomorrow. And so I'm sorry I keep coming this side, but I can't stand there. And so the question is, what is a circumstellar bubble? And this was actually, first thought about by Weaver et al. In 1977, about 30 years ago. And basically you have a star, and this star gives off a fast wind, which is basically a supersonic wind, something supersonic, compared to the surrounding medium. It drives a shock into the surrounding medium. The shock sweeps up material into a shell. Behind the surrounding medium, this material is slowed down. The wind still has to be slowed down, so a reverse or inner or wind termination shock is formed, which actually goes back into the wind. And so you basically get this kind of a structure. You have the star giving off a fast wind termination shock, shocked fast wind, contact discontinuity, shock surrounding medium, and the outer shock. If you look at the density and pressure profiles, this is what it looks like, a shock. This is the freely flowing wind, 1 over r squared. Here's a wind termination shock, an almost constant density region, contact discontinuity, very thin shell, outer shock, which is usually radiative, so it cools, and that's why you get this dense and thin shell where, as you can see, the shock jump in this case from a simulation is about a factor of 100 or so, and then the surrounding medium. The region is very high, hot, high-pressure bubble, and so high pressure, low density, high temperature. It's actually got X-ray emitting temperatures, and you should see it in X-rays, but we hardly see any of them in X-rays because the emission measures turn out to be quite low. And as I said, I'll point this out to you later. Sorry?
Pressure plot.
Sorry, the pressure is, what do you mean? Oh, yeah, well, this pressure is assumed to go just as the density. So as the density decreases 1 over r squared, the pressure decreases.
Is that just the internal pressure or also the rho v squared?
This is just the wind pressure. So sort of, given the wind density and temperature. Yeah, it's a thermal pressure. I'm not sure. Is that what you're asking? Oh, okay. So if the wind... If the wind properties are constant, the bubble will eventually evolve to a self-similar state. So you can get, constant mass loss, constant velocity. You get a self-similar solution, which is the one worked out by Weaver et al. But, time evolution, the winds will change, rotation, magnetic fields, multidimensional effects, all kinds of things will come into play. And so you'll get multiple shells, instabilities, and turbulence. And that's what we are going to sort of look at. Okay, so that's what the circumstellar bubble that we keep talking about looks like. What about the supernova ejecta? We need a description for it. Honestly, we don't know what the supernova ejecta looks like in almost anything. The closest idea we have is only for 87A, where the ejecta sort of looks like a power law decreasing with radius or velocity. with, you know, with the power law index given as approximately 9. So if you have a density going as a power law, and then you have the surrounding medium whose density also goes as a power law, then you can get a similar solution which was worked out by Chevalier in 82, and you basically get the same structure: outer shock, reverse shock, contact discontinuity. The structure of the density profile looks a bit different, but you get the same two shocks and contact discontinuity structure again. And so this is what you're going to get. If the contact discontinuity basically goes as T to some power, where once you fix the power law of the ejecta and the surrounding medium, this is a constant quantity. So T to the M, where M is a constant, and this is important to remember. Pardon? Here? And this? This is r to the minus 2 in this case, this is r to the minus 7 or whatever. Yeah. Okay, so now you have a supernova ejecta you can describe. You have the circumstellar medium, you run the supernova into the circumstellar bubble, and I'll show you lots of simulations just to give you some idea. So first of all, as I said, the initial interaction is with a low density bubble interior. And if you remember, I should have got this plot. If you remember, look at this, you know, this is the ISM density about 1. This density is about a factor of 4 orders of magnitude lower. So the supernova is interacting with something in this case which is 4 orders of magnitude lower. If the emission goes a density squared, it will be 8 orders of magnitude lower. So basically this muffled, and that's the first thing you learn with supernova with low density bubbles. The luminosity is far lower than in the ISM. And this may be a reason why you don't see many of them. So as we said, there's not much mass in this whole bubble. Most of the mass is contained in this dense thin shell which is at the edge of the bubble. So the entire dynamics depends on this mass of the shell, and you can basically parameterize it with one parameter, mass of the shell to the mass of the ejecta, which we call as a parameter lambda. So if lambda is very small compared to 1, it has no effect. As you keep increasing lambda, of course, the effect is much larger. So in young supernova remnants, you know, it'll be approximately 1, and for E7A, we can say it's about 0.2, but this only takes into account the mass that we see, which is the ionized mass. We don't know how much neutral mass is there in the ring. We are interested in these cases where lambda is 1 greater than 1. I'll just show you an example just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about. I won't go into too much detail because I want to talk about a specific case. So this is one, for example, where lambda is 0.14, which means that the mass in the dense shell is about 14% that of the ejecta. Just to give you an idea, so here's the density scaling on this side, pressure scaling on this side. Red is the density, green is the pressure. This is the time in years. Here's the supernova ejecta, which is interacting with this 1 over r squared profile. Here's the wind termination shock. Here's the thin, dense shell. This grid is also, as you can see, this grid was actually expanding with time. So as you look at this, this will increase quite a bit. And this simulations, by the way, were all done with John Blondin's VH1 code. So, and this grid size will keep expanding with time. I have to somehow control this and not get blinded. So I hope this works. Okay. Oh, this is weird. Okay, so the supernova interacts, I have to do this from here. The supernova starts interacting with the profile, it runs into the wind termination shock, you get this outer shock reflected, you get a transmitted shock and a reflected shock, and you can see this high pressure region out here. Every time you have this kind of interaction, you'll get a high pressure region, you'll get an increase in the X-ray and optical luminosity. You get a transmitted and reflected shock. This whole structure will go and bang into the dense shell. You'll get another transmitted shock, another reflected shock, which will go up the profile. And so you can see that the dynamics is quite complicated. The reason why I mentioned this is because, you know, when you're calculating things like the X-ray emission and stuff, which comes from, you know, the region between the shocks, the shocked interaction region, you have to take this into account. The structure is very different from the kind of structure that you'd get just by imagining, you know, the supernova going into a wind or a constant density medium. It doesn't do either. And so you have to take these things into account. So as you see, you let it go on, and the supernova, and this whole structure now interacts with the dense shell. You get a transmitted shock coming here, a reflected shock going back here. So reflected shock will go up this incline, And then as you can see, you look at the density structure out here, and now slowly this whole density structure is going to change. And as you can see, there. So let me just run this again quickly. Time is in years. So there, interaction with the wind termination shock, transmitted reflected shocks, interacting with the dense shell, reflected shock, transmitted shock. When you have an interaction with a dense shell, the reflected shock moves faster than it would actually if it was just a supernova shock. And so it actually thermalizes the medium much faster than you would have. So this is just a basic example of showing, you know, when you have a supernova in a wind-blown bubble, what happens. Just to emphasize one thing, I told you that this expansion parameter is that t to the m. I pointed out the m is what I call the expansion parameter. In a normal case for a wind or a constant density medium, this would be a constant, and that's what you get in this little region when it's expanding in the wind. And then you see how dramatically it changes over time. If you measure it at any one given point, you're going to get a value which is not indicative of the true value, because it's going to be changing with time. And so this happens for a lot of supernovae. I think, you know, you get a value at a given time, it's not going to be indicative of the phase it is in. A lot of people use the expansion parameter to determine what phase it's in, but that's not going to be true. Another point to the X-ray luminosity, just the free and free bound luminosity is calculated by one of the codes. You can see it's pretty low in the beginning, jumps up really high, and then stays about much constant. But this is where the shock interacts with the shell, and it jumps up quite a bit, you know, by order three orders of magnitude. And so again, you know, the X-ray luminosity, as you can see, it's very important to take the shock shell interaction into account. As you increase this value of this lambda, the energy transmitted by the supernova remnant to the shell obviously becomes greater. You'll keep transmitting more energy, the shock will be slowed down, the reflected shock will become faster, it'll go back through the ejecta faster, which means that it'll thermalize the ejecta faster. The transmitted shock, on the other hand, will probably become slower with time because they're losing more energy to the shell. And in some cases, the reflected shock, almost the entire remnant will be hot, and you might get like X-rays all the way to the center. I have some simulations, but I don't have time to show them now. If you increase this parameter quite a lot, then what happens is that almost all the energy from the supernova remnant going to the shell, it begins to lose most of its energy, so it becomes completely radiative. And the shock might get stuck in the shell, and you may not get a transmitted shock at all. And you'll get a reflected shock that goes pretty far back quickly, but there'll be no transmitted shock. In that case, what basically happens is that the supernova will go from a classically expanding stage to the radiative stage without ever going through a Sydow stage at all. In general, you can reduce the Sydow stage quite a bit if you have, you know, interaction with a shell. You may not have a Sydow stage, or you may have it completely reduced. Again, as I said, if you just look at the expansion parameter, it won't tell you the whole story at all. Okay, so I just wanted to give you this brief introduction, and then, of course, you know, you want to take a more explicit case, something where, you know, you can take a simulation and say, like, okay, this is the medium around the star, this is my supernova expanding, what happens? So I have a lot of models, but I'll show you specifically one that I took from Norbert Langer, and I think you may hear more about all these things tomorrow. This is for a 35 solar mass star, and instead of reading all this, I'll just show you the plots. So this is the mass loss rate for the stellar evolution model. It starts out at a low mass loss rate, few into the minus 7, goes up to a red supergiant where it goes up almost to 10 to the minus 4, and then decreases a little bit by a factor of a few, but not much. So very low, goes up to almost 3 orders of magnitude, and then decreases a little bit. Look at the velocity. So the velocity starts off as very high in the main sequence stage, reduces to about 70 in this case. It should actually go down to 10 to 20 because it's a red supergiant, and then jumps up again to a very high value, a few thousand kilometers per second for a Wolf-Rayet stage, like what you'd expect. Okay, so here is the simulation. Same thing, pressure, red is density, green is pressure, time in years, V is the velocity of the wind in kilometers per second, and mass loss rate in solar masses per year. Just to show you how this thing evolves in 1D before we go to 2D. So this is, you know, so what I do is, stellar evolution calculations, I calculate the wind velocity, mass loss rate at each point, and compute the evolution of the surrounding medium. So you start this off, and here you get a nice, you know, wind-blown bubble, just like a, you know, sort of idealized picture. Remember that even though these things are changing, you get this nice wind-blown bubble, just what you'd expect. 1 over r squared wind termination shock, constant density, etc., etc. This is about 4.7 million years. This is the main sequence stage. So it stays like this for a long time in the main sequence, just like you'd expect. Now the velocity is reducing of the wind. Soon the velocity will become very low, and now it's the red supergiant stage. You can see the wind velocity is reduced quite a lot. The mass loss rate has increased. And you get a new pressure equilibrium, and you get a red supergiant wind forming. You don't get a wind-blown bubble because this is a lower velocity, but you'll get a termination shock, and the material will pile up along the termination shock. So here's the red supergiant stage. And this is what it looks like. Okay, this I stopped it a bit too late. After that, the wind velocity goes up again, the mass loss rate decreases, but not much, and you get a Wolf-Rayet stage forming. And here is the Wolf-Rayet bubble. What happens is the Wolf-Rayet wind interacts with the red supergiant wind, and you get a little wind-blown bubble, just like the big one you had. You get a wind-blown bubble out here, outer shock, reverse shock contact, and you see the same structure forming. Obviously, this has a very high momentum compared to this one. So what's happening in 1D is this is going to take this shell, push it all the way out, and then reflect back again because it can't do anything else. 5 minutes? Okay. So this is going to push it out because it can't do anything else. So there it goes, pushes it out, it bangs into the dense shell and reflects back again. These little things are numerical, but don't worry about them. But you can see the kind of structure that we get, and it's not really that different from the idealized model, but there's a lot more structure in it. You always get the 1 over r squared, wind termination shock, almost a constant density and dense shell. So this is the kind of structure, this is after all these phases, main sequence, red supergiant, Wolf Rayet. So it's not that different, but it is somewhat different. If you calculate the X-ray luminosity of the bubble, like I told you, except for the fact where it bangs into the shell, most of the luminosity is so low. If you look at this with Chandra XMM, you won't see anything. You can see that the luminosities are very low, and that's why I think we don't see many of these. What happens to the supernova in this? It's just like what you did. The supernova shockwave, I assume, at the end of this 35 solar mass simulation, there's a 9 solar mass star left. I assume that, you know, you leave a remnant behind, you have 7.6 solar masses or so, which bangs into this and try to see what happens. It's more interesting to see it in 2D, so I'll do this very fast. You have the same kind of thing again. You have the supernova remnant banging into the wind termination shock. You get an outer and reverse shock. Then it goes and bangs into this high-density structure out here. You can see this high-pressure region that's formed out there. Most of the emission is going to come from this stage at this point. Again, you can see the termination transmitted shock, reflected shock. Goes and hits it, you get a reflected shock going all the way back, it re-reflects off the boundary, the transmitted shock in the meanwhile goes and hits that, you get a transmitted shock there. You can see how many shocks are going back and forth. And again, this is the point I want to emphasize, not the details, but the fact that you have lots of shocks going back and forth, the dynamics are very, and the emission is coming from different parts of the remnant, and that has to be taken into account. So, as you can see, it keeps going, shocks keep going crisscrossing back and forth. Just run it once more. And you can see the kind of complicated dynamics that we have. Look at the X-ray emission, and this is again X-ray luminosity during the supernova state. This is what you get. Due to all the shocks banging into each other, at that time you have an increase in the X-ray. Otherwise, normally you have a pretty low level of X-ray emission. And in some cases, it goes up quite a bit. So, and the last thing I want to show you is in 2D what this whole thing looks like. So here's the Wolf Rayet bubble in 2D. The same kind of evolution again. This is the main sequence. You get the dense shell, the inner shock forming out here, and there's a velocity and mass loss rate. But in 2D, this whole thing becomes unstable, and this is due to Vishniac type of thin shell instabilities, and you see a lot of turbulence in the interior. So there it goes. It becomes unstable. You see a lot of turbulence inside. The wind termination shock is still there. And now it's the red supergiant wind is coming out. So you can see it comes out. It doesn't go out very far, of course. This is also unstable due to a different type of Vishniac instability. And I don't have time to discuss that, but you can see what happens to it. Here's the red supergiant wind. It goes to this is all as far as it goes. So this is the main sequence shell, which is completely unstable to the pressure-driven type Vishniac type thin shell. So this is a different one. Then the Wolf Rayet wind comes out. In 2D, of course, the wind is again unstable, but it also breaks up the whole red supergiant shell and mixes everything up. So it'll mix everything up, as you can see. The whole thing bangs into this, and so even though the wind wouldn't have gone very far, it actually is brought into the whole bubble, and all the material is mixed into the surrounding medium. And since most of the mass is lost in the red supergiant stage, this is important. So you can see what happens finally. I mean, all the material is mixed in. So this is, just run it quickly again. So this is main sequence. Lots of turbulence, red supergiant, Wolf Rayet, it all gets mixed up. And so at the end of the thing, this is what it looks like. The wind termination shock is aspherical. The whole interior is quite complicated. Look at the velocity contours, and the whole shell is completely fragmented. This is what the density structures look like. It's not too bad. In 30 years, we've actually got the same structure as the Viva et al. Model with a few wiggles in them. The fact is we can understand the wiggles. And so that's good. But you can get the similar kind of structure. But you know, in detail, it's very different. And if you run a supernova into this, this is what my supernova doesn't want to run into this. Okay, so I start off with a nice spherical supernova shockwave and just see what happens to it. That's the one main point I want to look at the supernova shockwave. Because of the aspherical wind termination shock, because of the turbulence, because of the pressure, and because of a lot of things which I can't go into, look at the structure of the shockwave. It becomes aspherical and it becomes corrugated. And okay, this is great. And then the shockwave hits the shell. As I told you, when the shock hits the shell, you get a brightening in the optical and X-ray. But look at this. It hits the shell at different times at different So, you know, first this part will hit the shells out here, and then this one will hit, and then this one will hit, and then maybe this and this. So it hits the shell at different points instead of all together. And as you can see, when that happens, and you get a reflected shock which comes back also, you know, sort of very fragmented, and some of it goes and hits. There's a lot of dynamics going on which I won't go into. But the point I want to emphasize is the fact that, you know, the shock hits the shell at different points. And let me just run that again and show you that. Yeah, so you can again see it. Here's the shock hitting the shell here, then there, then there. And so, you know, at each point, so different parts of the shell will brighten up at different times. And where do we see that? Well, there is a case where we see that, and that is in supernova 87A. We see a very similar thing where you see one spot brightening up, and then a few spots, and then a few more, and then a few more. In 2003, almost the entire ring was brightening up. Actually, I think there's a couple more figures I don't have where the entire ring brightens up. But so that's basically, you know, that you can get this kind of a structure because you get these kind of shock waves. Of course, there's a lot more going on in supernova 87A, and this is not a simulation for supernova 87A, I should emphasize, but I just want to sort of talk about this. I don't have time to talk about GRB afterglows. We were calculating them, but you can ask me about that later. So I just want to put up my conclusions. The evolution of the shockwave is altered when the supernova explodes in a windblown cavity. It can alter the shape of the shockwave, the appearance of the remnant. Explosion is spherically symmetric, the resulting remnant isn't, and the impact will result in increase in the X-ray radio. And then it will no longer evolve through all the stages. And finally, what do we need next? We need better stellar evolution calculations, first of all. So, thank you.
Thank you, Vikram. Question here.
In the case of the you did mention that if the remnant of the supernova remnant evolves inside these windblown bubbles, the X-ray flux is very low because of, you know, and then it goes up as it as it hits the wall. One thing that would be that you could see as that hits the wall, and I infer that the reverse shock goes very fast until the end because it's propagating to a very rarefied ejecta, is that the ionization time scale, the ionization age of those ejecta, it should be very, very very low because of the low density.
Okay.
And the temperature should be very high.
Yeah, it is.
Have you established any connection with any known object in those terms?
No, I haven't actually tried that. But actually, I have calculated things like, you know, the X-ray surface brightness and try to see if you get X-ray emission and stuff. Yeah, the temperature is very high, but as you said, there isn't much density there. The emission measures are very low. I haven't actually tried to get any further details. But if you're interested in that, I would certainly like to do that. Yeah.
Yeah, I can show you some.
Which objects are you talking about? Which objects are you talking about? No, which objects are you making?
That was my question. I mean, there is no object that I know of where you could actually see these, that the ejecta have very low ionization time scale and are very hot.
Well, but the question is, which objects are there which you can clearly tell that the supernova has interacted with a windblown shell? There's 87A for sure. Which other ones are there? And I think there's N132D is mentioned sometimes. I don't know if that's true, or maybe some of the X-ray people can tell me more. Okay.
And temperature very high?
Well, it depends on where you're. Oh, I thought that, okay.
When you showed the results of the 1D calculation for the X-rays from the supernova remnant, it showed these very sharp spikes at times at certain points in the evolution. To what extent does that carry over into the 2D calculations, or do you expect certain points in the evolution where it's especially X-ray bright?
Well, it won't show the sharp spikes. I mean, the sharp spikes are because the whole shock is hitting the shell at one, as you know. And of course, in the 2D where you have the fragments and stuff, it won't be so sharp. I haven't tried to do it in 2D because I haven't done it very carefully. You will have the similar kind of structure, but it may be reduced and you might have a more shallow sort of rise or something. That's what I expect, at least, you know. And in some cases, especially in the cases where, you know, you have the 2D and the shock is hitting it at different points, so obviously you're not going to get the full rise in X-ray at one point. So I think it'll be very shallow, but it's something that I'm still planning to do. I mean, to calculate the X-ray emission from the 2D, I haven't yet done that. There was a question here.
So, At least during the when the Wolf-Rayet wind goes off in the red giant phase, it's going to go off dramatically off center for those objects. So how much of this behavior that you've been seeing with these spherical shells is going to carry over to the case where the red giant is basically a trail and the Wolf-Rayet phase is going off not in a symmetrical external medium.
Well, but I guess that depends on how far it is, right? I mean, it's still going to... Well, I mean, so what you can imagine is that instead of having this kind of a structure, maybe you get the red giant, and then you have the Wolf-Rayet, sort of a Wolf-Rayet shell form, which is aspherical. So you can imagine it that way, right? That you have an aspherical Wolf-Rayet shell in this phase, which sort of hits it. So in one direction, it'll hit the red giant phase faster, and the other direction will be much slower. Something... Oh, okay, but it'll be the same thing, right? I mean, in one place where it's closer, it's going to do it much faster. It might punch through at the other place. I haven't tried that, but, you know, there are a lot of effects that I want to put in slowly onwards. But, I mean, the basic effect is still going to be the same. It's just a question of, you know, how far the Wolf-Rayet is. So in one case where it is closer, it's going to just bang into it much earlier and, you know, break it all up faster. In the other direction, it's sort of going to expand a bit more, be slower by the time it hits it, and then go off, right? I mean, but it's the basic dynamics, so I don't think will change too much. Oh, I see. If because of the motion, if you create something like, yeah, like, okay, yeah, I actually, yeah, that's true. And well, there are a lot of things which I want to do. There's a lot more which I didn't talk about too. There are a lot of other things which I want to put into this. This was just a starting point for trying some of these simulations. I thought there was a question somewhere, but.
Well, I think we are running a bit out of time, okay. So. I'm afraid we have to stop the discussion here. So I'd like to thank Vikram again. And the next speaker is Stefan.